This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Hello and welcome. I'm Tim Oates, ARD Group Director here at Cambridge Assessment, and it's my pleasure today to introduce Michael Young, who's been doing some very important work nationally and internationally on this issue of how we should understand the concept of knowledge in the context of curriculum thinking. Okay, I want to read out a quote, and I checked this whether this was okay with Michael. Now, some of you, so it was Mary and Philippa, will have heard this before, and Russell, of course. Pupils did not learn Latin and Greek in order to speak them, to become waiters, interpreters, or commercial letter writers. They learnt them in order to know at first hand the civilization of Greece and of Rome, a civilization that was a necessary precondition of our modern civilization. In other words, they learnt them in order to be themselves and to know themselves consciously. Latin and Greek were learnt through their grammar, mechanically. But the accusation of formalism and aridity is very unjust and inappropriate. In education, one is dealing with children in whom one has to inculcate certain habits of diligence, precision, poise, even physical poise. Ability to concentrate on specific subjects, which cannot be acquired without the mechanical repetition of disciplined and methodical acts. Now, when I ask audiences of teachers who's that from, that quote, they say Michael Gove. Or alternatively, Michael Wilshaw. Some of you will be familiar with the fact that comes from Gramsci, imprisoned, of course, by the fascists. And that's from the section of the prison notebooks, which is comes under the title "The Means of Creating Intellectuals from the Working Class." Okay, now that's food for thought in terms of the contemporary debate, I think, about a knowledge-based curriculum. So I'll just go through a few key points by way of introduction to Michael. And unusually, those of you who know me, I usually extemporise, but I've written this down, so be assured it is reasonably short. The English education community appears addicted to its paradigm wars and polemical oppositions. What it seems more reluctant to engage in is scientific accumulation, something to which Cambridge Assessment is strongly committed, and I know Michael is committed to as well. And this debate is all part of scientific accumulation in respect of the curriculum. In 2008, a false opposition surely had embedded itself in education discourse in England. An opposition between knowledge and skills. A totemic opposition which stands scant scrutiny. After all, purposeful and effective human endeavour is characterised by complex integration of knowledge and skill. Whether that be the work of a scholar here in Cambridge, a financial analyst in the city, a nursing professional, or an aircraft technician. Errow and Boreham's work demonstrates absolutely the link between knowledge and skill, not least in knowledge being a vital constituent of skilled performance. In this, I'm not saying that knowledge and skill are the same. I'm just saying that the nature of their presentation in the oppositional discourse is wrong. Yet battle lines were drawn up and skirmishing established. Knowledge-based became a term redolent of conservative preoccupation with a traditional curriculum, while skills-based became progressive preoccupation with the process, not the content of learning. While all children are potential victims of this dysfunctional exchange, in 2007, one clear victim was the national curriculum. The 2007 curriculum was a dramatically truncated statement of the content of subjects. The reassurance by those leading that review that subject content had been retained was an empty one. Rich conceptual content, faithful to the structure and content of knowledge in specific disciplines, and vital to the concept of curriculum entitlement, had been removed. Subject boundaries, the launch communication stated, were traditional, regressive impediments to a motivating curriculum. Important, then, that recent empirical work in schools by Cure shows command of discipline knowledge by teachers to be a key element of the performance of outstanding schools. It's a tribute to Simon Liebus, Chief Executive of Cambridge Assessment, that when in 2008 I took my concerns to him regarding the curriculum in 2007, that he said we should open public debate about the problems. our perspectives, laid down some of the key principles for the 2010 review of the national curriculum. Speaking personally, I see the job of responsible social scientists as laying bare the underlying trends and tendencies in what otherwise is referred to as zeitgeist, something not given but constructed. If implicit and uncritical, developing zeitgeist can lead society in peculiar and unhelpful directions. The skills-knowledge opposition is tangible in the zeitgeist, yet is ill-founded and dysfunctional. It shuts down access for some young people to the very things which open doors for them. Access to powerful knowledge was, during the 1930s and 1940s, for the theorists of the left, a critical pathway to greater equity in society. How odd that it should now be seen as a preoccupation of the right. It's been a huge pleasure to throw ideas around on knowledge with Michael over the last 4 years. Michael Young's work lays bare the dysfunctional thinking which has entered the discourse in England on curriculum. He challenges the idea of beginning and, crucially, ending on where the child is, highlighting the necessary counterintuitive form of the knowledge which has been hard won by human society. He challenges the false oppositions and reductivist thinking which has entered discussion of curriculum issues, including the empty "it's a knowledge-based curriculum," which so frequently derives from an incredibly impoverished notion of what knowledge actually comprises. So with that, I will hand over to Michael. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Cambridge Assessment and Simon, for inviting me. And I particularly felt that I should congratulate whoever it is in that organisation who is so good at marketing, because so many of you are here. And I think that's very impressive. And also thank you to Tim, because clearly I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Tim. We go back a long way to the days when we were debating competence, national vocational qualifications, when Tim was for a short time on a project at the Institute of Education. But I think there was a gap where we didn't see so much of each other. And then I picked up his two papers that he wrote when he came to Cambridge Assessment, Missing the Point and Could Do Better, which I think are particularly nice titles, as a matter of fact. And they certainly had a big influence on my thinking about the curriculum in the last 4 or 5 years, no question about it, and still do. And I also remember a talk, I think he and I were both speaking at a conference of SCET, and he documented with some very simple data from the different phases of the national curriculum how the science curriculum had had its content progressively evacuated over the years, which I think told a disturbing story. And I suppose it told a particularly disturbing story because before I became a sociologist at university, I used to teach chemistry, so I kind of have a sort of long biographical interest in the science curriculum, and even wrote a couple of papers at one time, so that's why I'm particularly glad somewhere to see Michael Rice, my colleague who's Professor of Science Education, tonight. Right, now the title up there, and it's not now, but maybe you'll try that, is Attack on Knowledge, when in a sense really this talk is about the defence of knowledge. It's about the case for it, but in a sense, and as I'll come to a little bit later, there's something rather bizarre about there being an attack on knowledge at all. When I actually wrote the text, I changed it slightly and I called the title of the paper The Curriculum and the Entitlement to Knowledge, because it seems to me that that idea, and as I'll come to a little bit later, this notion of powerful knowledge, which I think we don't want to make too much of it, but I think it's quite helpful. That is, in a sense, I think, a very crucial element of what I want to say. And it's manifestly clear that, in fact, we haven't achieved that in this country. So, loosely, I want to explore the idea that the curriculum, the school curriculum, is or should be an entitlement to knowledge. And this requires a certain amount of clarification, which, not necessarily formal, I hope one way or another I shall have touched on in the course of tonight. So I will, at some point, introduce this concept of powerful knowledge and suggest that it is at least worthwhile thinking about as a useful principle. I need to say a little bit about where it comes from, because in a sense, and I'll come back to that, but in a sense it comes from within my discipline, which is sociology of education. But because people talk about power and knowledge in different ways all the time, it certainly is no way our property. Second thing is that, in fact, I want to distinguish two notions of entitlement, and I will elaborate on that. One is the general notion of entitlement to knowledge. The other is crucially different, the entitlement to knowledge for all. And I want to hold on to that because I think it's really important. I think it's important, and I've written about this on a number of occasions, to make a distinction between a national and a school curriculum. I'm interested how these issues that in fact have come so public in this country are beginning to be picked up across the world. And I went to speak in Brazil in November, and there's an enormous amount of interest in the idea of a core curriculum and what the nature of the knowledge in the core curriculum should be, for very interesting historical reasons, which I will come back to. I think it is extremely important, and again, I think this is something that I picked up and developed in my own way from one of Tim's papers, to make a distinction between curriculum and pedagogy, because I think that's one thing that particularly that the national curriculum as espoused by the previous government actually failed to do. And you get into an impossible debate when people say, well, why isn't this child, or why isn't this community, why is that not involved in the national curriculum? So I think that distinction that, in a sense, and put it briefly to start with, that the curriculum is about where you hope your pupils are going to go, and pedagogy is about how you involve them and their experiences and their knowledge from outside the school in actually reaching that goal. So those are very, very distinct. And I remember once writing, and I think it's worth stressing in a sense, that one thing that that young people do not want to do when they come to school is to learn more about the experience they already have. The whole thing is that they should actually engage with that. Now, despite our hosts this evening being leading examination board, apart from a few brief comments at the beginning, I'm going to leave this topic, very, very important topic, an inescapable topic in thinking about the curriculum or anything, as outside my brief. But just a few comments that I felt I couldn't not make at the beginning. All the likely pressures on schools are going to be for an assessment system which drives both curriculum and pedagogy. And the question, I think, is how can that be resisted so that, in a sense, that driving is reversed? And that actually has got to be something that, in a sense, the exam boards, the teachers, and those designing national curriculum have got to engage in. And this is not at all to say that we don't need assessment, but to remind us that we have a rather peculiar history and a peculiar system in this country. We have a long history of no national curriculum at all. School exams essentially operated as a national curriculum pre-1988. And from the point of view of my theme this evening, they actually did a better job in specifying the knowledge for the national curriculum than most of the national curriculum versions we've had since 1988. One particular exception, of course, and this and there always are exceptions, and that is that, in fact, they weren't able to handle the issue of, in fact, the discrimination in relation to science for, between girls and boys. And that has been massively transformed from 1988, and I think that's important to state. What that exam model of the national curriculum managed to do was to give autonomy to schools and enable universities to play a major role in setting exams and syllabuses and maintaining standards. The problems rose when the system started to expand from the 1960s, and I think, and this may not, you may not agree with me at all, when there started to be that shift from norm reference assessment to criterion reference assessment. As so many educational innovations, criterion reference assessment started off as a good idea, but it lost control of its own development. It struck me when I was thinking about that as a sociologist, that's an example of what Max Weber said about what happened to rationality. The other point was that the close link between universities and schools, which was a feature of their role in the examining from the late 19th century, was substantially weakened as the kind of mediating role between them of the QCA and the QCDA and its predecessors took over. One of the reasons I welcome the Secretary of State's proposal that universities should, in a sense, reinvent a version of their role that they began in the 19th century because of its potential for actually establishing links between those who teach undergraduates and those close with those who teach, the teachers who teach future undergraduates. This is going to be very tricky, and I can understand the initial reaction of the universities was fairly negative, because when you've got 150 universities, it's a tricky and complex task, and it may suggest quite a significant amount of reorganisation. That, in a sense, is all I'm going to say about assessment. I think there's no doubt about it that despite the expansion in many ways of the system, that the central role of knowledge in education has undoubtedly declined over the years. This is despite all the talk about the knowledge economy and the expansion of opportunities. So I want to start then by identifying two trends which challenge the idea that education should be an entitlement to knowledge. And I'll refer to them as the educational challenge and the political challenge. Now we need to remember the political challenge because it comes from a government, comes from government wider society. But in a sense, we need to take on the educational challenge, those of us who work in the education system, because in a sense, if knowledge has declined, we have a significant responsibility for it. We need to think about how we can limit the decline and even hopefully reverse it. So those are the attacks I shall be most focused on. Now, the educational challenge to knowledge is located within the education community, and it's associated with the policies of many of the pre-2010 governments, Labour and Conservative, but especially with the pre-2010 Labour government. It struck me that if your Prime Minister thinks that your education policy is the best economic policy a country has, then it's hardly surprising that in fact knowledge will not be a high-profile issue for education, because no economy itself has ever driven, in my view, ever driven the development of knowledge. It, in a sense, is the other way around. The other thing to say is the educational attacks on knowledge were largely implicit until 2010. They were alive in the rather abstract and esoteric debates within cultural studies and the social sciences, where there are endless debates and arguments that there is no such thing as objective knowledge. And unfortunately, those debates and arguments have become a growing feature of educational studies with the enthusiasm for various kinds of French post-structural philosophy. They've also, equally sadly, spilled over into my own discipline, the sociology of education. Here's an American philosopher who expresses this view very clearly, and I think it's in no way an exceptional assertion. All knowledge, he says, is situated knowledge, reflecting the position of the producer or the knower at a certain historical moment in a given cultural context. If knowledge is situated, this leads inescapably to a relativist position which rejects the assumption of there being better knowledge that could and should underpin a curriculum. Thus, the curriculum becomes amenable to a whole range of purposes other than the acquisition of knowledge. Perhaps the most significant and least discussed aspect of this argument is the idea that there's no knowledge that's important enough that it should take precedence over the demands of pupil or student motivation, their interests, or indeed their performance. Now, I want to illustrate this claim with reference to some recent historical examples. But before doing so, I should mention the sea change in attitudes to knowledge that came with the election of the coalition government. The scepticism about knowledge that characterized many of the education community was suddenly faced with an open and explicit alternative. The present government's approach, proposals for national curriculum, their new emphasis on subject knowledge, and their plans for revising examinations. It was then that the educational skeptics within the educational the knowledge skeptics within the educational community became explicit and in their attacks on knowledge, and explicit in their political and inextricably related opposition to the government policies in general. We've seen this in countless newspaper columns of distinguished journalists and former secretaries of state, and multiple letters from the press from people who call themselves leading teacher educators. So I'll draw on two kinds of arguments this evening in my talk. One is a loosely historical one, and one more personal and subjective. In the former, I'll trace this scepticism about knowledge in the curriculum reforms from the 1970s and take us up to the situation we reached by 2010. We should actually be aware of the fact that the government, that the coalition government was only able to introduce its reforms in such a kind of fast way because of the work done by the think tanks which advise the Conservative Party when they're in opposition. We should have perhaps paid more attention to them at the time, but most of us didn't. Having done that little historical survey, I'll then offer you some personal reflections on the extent to which what some have called a fear of knowledge actually pervades much educational thinking, in the education community, and more broadly, those, in fact, who see themselves on the left and are involved in education. Both, I would have thought, are groups one might have expected to defend the entitlement to knowledge as a right for all pupils. But on the whole, they don't. Now, I say this section will be personal rather than formally researched for a particular reason. I came into the debates about the curriculum from the sociology of education, of which more later. But nothing prepared me for the level and intensity of opposition from those, particularly those on the left, to anything that might be associated with Michael Gove's policy reforms for the curriculum. I'm no Michael Gove supporter, far from it, but we have to accept, I think, all of us, whatever our views about all range of policies, that he's opened up a debate about the curriculum that was not even suggested from the 1988 curriculum onwards, and in a sense was delayed far, far too long. Following the endorsement of some of my ideas by the expert group on the curriculum that was led by Tim Oates, some even have suggested various things to me. One was that, in fact, I must have been a Gove speechwriter. Well, I wasn't. Another was that, in fact, I acted as a kind of quasi-left cover for right-wing politics. I leave that for you to judge. A third was that in fact an argument about powerful knowledge as the core of the curriculum implies a kind of deficit view of children, because what about all the knowledge they've got? This is what I have to deal with. In trying to argue that, in fact, as I have, that there's a case for knowledge in the curriculum is consistent with a policy of greater equality and social justice, I have lost good friends of 20 and 30 years of standing. Now, I mention these personal issues not because, in a sense, I'm obsessed with them, but because they point to, I think, how deep is the fracture of ideas that the government policies have actually brought out and made explicit. As far as I can see, Gove has challenged two linchpins of political thought about education. Knowledge is right-wing and exclusive, and learning is progressive and left-wing. Maybe we ought to question some of these shibboleths. Or is it too uncomfortable when old resolutions and old coherences don't work anymore? A point I'll come back to. Is it that many of the cultural bonds holding political and educational ideas together in the past have actually been broken? Or is it that our broader politics in our neoliberal capitalist world become so diffuse that educational differences that have lain relatively dormant for years have come to the fore in the clearest expression of difference? Good writers and researchers dedicate, for instance, those dedicated to all through comprehensive education from 3 to 19, many of whose work I much admire, invariably avoid any discussion of the curriculum or knowledge and limit themselves only and solely to organisational questions. They seem acutely uncomfortable when curriculum issues come up. Why is this? Partly, I think, is that although they have a theory of comprehensive reorganisation, because it's much more difficult, they have no theory of a comprehensive curriculum. And that's what we saw happened in our comprehensive schools. Also, I think it may be because curriculum issues are difficult and they don't fit easily into either traditional left-right distinctions or debates about greater or lesser equality. We lack a kind of collective curriculum imagination that might replace those that we feel are increasingly out of date. The field that I've been associated with is curriculum studies, has become so frightened of knowledge that it escapes it into abstractions to such an extent that it almost loses its object. And the object being, what are kids actually learning in school? What about the traditional English model of liberal education, articulated so well by Paul Hurst in the 1960s, but with a much longer history? Might this be a basis for thinking about a less elitist, more liberal, a liberal form of education for today? Some philosophers start with well-being and happiness, but well-being and happiness are not specific to schools. They are actually a feature of any institution in our society as a whole. There's no educational discussion, for instance, of the contemporary relevance of the Leavis-Snow debate about two cultures. At the same time, in fact, our engineering faculties find it immensely difficult to recruit any home students. They rely entirely on Asia to sustain them, partly because of the fees, but because of the actual people as well. And I think that is a serious worry, because it seems quite likely in 20 or 30 years' time that those Asian countries will have their own faculties of education, and they won't need to send their students here. Is there any discussion, another we could learn from, and that is, in fact, Matthew Arnold and what I call his rather nostalgic egalitarianism, which actually managed to be egalitarian without any sense of the massive transformation of the economy of his time, and there's no mention of any science or technology, anything he writes. But nevertheless, in terms of his concept of culture, it was an egalitarian one. these writers seem dated to us now, but what they did do, I think, is to try and imagine a potentially common culture for their time, and that may be something that we could build on, at least if we're going to think about what a curriculum of the future might be like. Now, I mention these thoughts because they point to what I call an absent cultural resource, and possibly that they may explain why the curriculum debates have become so untextured and almost vitriolic. I will end, and I haven't got there yet, but what I have to say this evening with my specific response to the attacks and how we can actually learn from the go of reforms. And how, especially if we are to establish a more just form of entitlement, and also how I came from the sociology of knowledge to actually this idea of powerful knowledge as a curriculum principle. It doesn't solve all the problems, and one of its criteria, the importance of specialization, is a double-edged sword. But it might be, because in a sense, if you have specialization, then you have problems of integration and coherence in the curriculum as a whole. But it might be a resource for the education community if they're going to persuade governments of all parties of the conditions for such a principle as powerful knowledge to actually be realized. Now, I turn briefly to what I call the political challenge to knowledge. It's far from new, and it's less overt in what it is expressed. It's expressed in the policies of that same government which defends a knowledge-based curriculum. Here the question is, an entitlement to knowledge for whom? For the few or for all? Because there's a very big and dramatic difference. I'm sure, need to say it. Do government policies, in other words, consider the conditions for the significant extension of the entitlement to knowledge? Gove speaks about the fact that he wants high expectations for all. It's a fine phrase, but would he actually put in place the resources in the schools and the teachers that those high expectations could be realised? I'm not so sure. Or do they, in fact, rely largely on parent choice and market pressures now that most of the power is removed from the LEAs and the QCDA is abolished? Despite their support for a knowledge-led national curriculum, it's some of the government's economic policies that will influence how the entitlement to knowledge is actually distributed. I'll give you two examples that will be familiar to everyone. The reduction of state support for humanities degrees in the universities, which inevitably will concentrate humanities degrees in the top universities, where those from state schools are much less represented. And the restructuring of the educational maintenance grants for low-income families with children staying on at school after 16. So that, in a sense, is the political challenge, and I think it's important to always to hold on to it, even though, in a sense, I think it's not our responsibility directly to deal with it. So a brief bit of curriculum history. And I want, in a sense, it to give you a flavour of what I mean when I say that the implicit challenge to knowledge was the underlying relativism of the culture that in fact informed the curriculum changes. An early phase of curriculum reform, supported by the then Schools Council in the 1970s, was in response to the collapse of the youth labour market and the expansion of those staying on at school. There were a string of curriculum developments, some will remember, with titles like Mathematics for the Majority and Science and Geography for the Young School Leaver. The knowledge base of conventional subjects was weakened so that more practical work and community-oriented curricula could be developed, designed to interest the so-called academic child, who almost became a construct of the curriculum reforms themselves. Like the Newsom report, generated not only a Newsom child, but Newsom departments in schools. In the 1980s, the focus shifted towards examinations, initially by differentiating O-levels and CSEs, and later their integration in GCSE with its distinctive grade C boundary. Then in 1998, Tim referred to, came the first national curriculum, defining 10 subjects that were compulsory for every school, was introduced. It turned out to be totally unmanageable and led to teacher strikes. Progressively, during the next decade, its compulsory requirements were steadily reduced, so that two decades later, only maths, English, science, and RE remained compulsory through to 16. Schools were free to drop history, geography, and modern languages, and fewer offered single science subjects. Finally, from the late 2000s, there were two further steps in differentiating the curriculum on the basis of a scepticism about knowledge. One was the very popular RSA's Opening Minds curriculum, which used a competence model which emphasized pupils' own experience of the local community rather than subjects. Some of you will know the implications of this in the University of Bristol report, which showed a sharp discrepancy. They did a comparison of the schools who took up the RSA program, those that didn't, and they were divided almost equally, very strongly, on social class lines. At the same time, in the late 70s, the QCDA introduced equivalent levels on the basis of which non-GCSEs, such as personal social development, were given GCSE equivalents. So in each case, then, of this period, the criteria and the focus changed, but the links to an implicit relativism about the relationship to subject knowledge remained. And subjects were seen as the entitlement to knowledge for the few, not for all. The knowledge issue was more explicit in the early programs. For instance, in the mathematics for the majority curriculum, the emphasis was on mathematics oriented to its use in everyday life. However, the research by my colleague Paul Darling and others was to show mass curricula oriented to everyday context made it extremely difficult for students to grasp and use mathematical concepts independently of the context in which they'd first come across them. In other words, the so-called majority were excluded from the power of mathematics, and in a way, similar way in science and geography. The new curricula either rejected the idea that there was objectively better knowledge that was less bound to particular contexts or experience, or made implicit assumptions that such knowledge was not accessible to all children. However, at the same time, these developments contributed to the 30-year-on increase in pass rates at GCSE, and no one wanted to criticise teachers, so that for many years there was virtually no debate about the curricula at all, even those that relied on a highly flexible and relativist approach to knowledge. It took the election then of the coalition government in 2010 to actually change this, to open up the debate in a number of ways, particularly the introduction of the extended subject-based EBAC as a criterion for ranking school performance, and also the importance of Alison Wolfe's report and her findings on 14 to 19 vocational education. Wolfe's data showed that many of the vocational courses for 14 to 16-year-olds, despite enabling students to gain certificates equivalent to GCSEs, gained them little knowledge at the same time. Many of the courses later were to lose their eligibility for funding as schools began to switch back to academic subjects. One example of this is worth mentioning because it symbolises, I think, a wider problem in relation to the current government's policies, and that is in terms of resource distribution and the availability of specialist staff. A key finding of Alison Wolfe's report was that many students with low GCSE grades who started level one and level two vocational courses in colleges did not continue to study maths or English after the age of 16. This was something almost unique among European countries, and this was despite the fact that these were just the subjects that, when asked, employers always said were most important to them in their selection. The government has now made continuing to study English and mathematics compulsory for these students in further education college. However, many colleges have neither the staff nor the resources to offer students extended GCSE programs in English and maths. And so these students end up on courses on functional literacy and numeracy, which make later progress to GCSE extremely difficult and have limited credibility among employers. So to summarise, subject knowledge, as the base of the curriculum involves rules agreed by subject specialists, rules that lead to the best knowledge at any level and the possibility of progression. Curriculum policies since the 1970s, and of course in different ways before, modified these rules to develop new curricula that were designed to support slow or weak students. These were a series of pragmatic curriculum solutions responsive in the short term to difficult pedagogic situations when schools were faced with pupils not motivated but still remaining in school. On the other hand, they reflected a systematic failure to invest in new pedagogic approaches because low achievement or low motivation was not seen as a sufficiently acute problem. It was easier to be sceptical about knowledge. It's not surprising that the government reforms then represented a serious challenge to teachers involved, and there was, of course, considerable opposition. And also that, in fact, it highlighted a pedagogic curriculum and resource issue that was not going to be easily or quickly resolved. The only solution, as I see it, is a research-based programme that leads to recognised certificates in, for instance, maths and English and other subject knowledge for students at the age of 17 or 18. In other words, instead of modifying knowledge criteria, the solution is to extend the learning time. But that, of course, raises resource problems. That requires government funds and teacher confidence with the support the assumption is, and I would make it, and certainly colleagues I've spoken to in FE would support this, that most existing vocational students could reach GCSE at grade C in maths and English if they were given the necessary support. Now, I turn from that brief sort of historical survey to the elements or examples of the fear of knowledge in the education community in this country and elsewhere. The title was Knowledge Under Attack. The question is knowledge really under attack? It is, in a way, a bizarre question. How could anyone be against knowing more about something? How could all students on a course not be entitled to the best knowledge there is in relation to what they're studying? And yet such ideas are attacked and resisted. The American philosopher Paul Bogossian refers to the fear of knowledge. Here's one example that illustrates, I think, his case in education well. A colleague of mine spends a lot of his time visiting students on teaching practice. He commented that in all the schools he went to, one thing he never heard was teachers talking about discussing what knowledge they was being taught and what knowledge kids were learning. They discussed behavior, they discussed attitude, they discussed test scores, but never what the students were learning or what might excite students to help them see the world in new ways. It was as if emphasizing knowledge was something that was going to intimidate the student and might put them off getting the grades that, in fact, the school needed them to get. Another way this fear of knowledge is manifest is in how learning has taken over as the kind of leitmotif of education in a whole number of areas. For instance, we have a module which I teach on at the Institute, which is, in fact, called vocational learning. Nothing principle wrong with that, but not vocational education. Why? Because learning is seen as extending, good, open, progressive, and creating opportunities for new learning. However, an emphasis on always being open to new learning has its problems. Take the ubiquitous learning to learn. It can emphasis as one of the kind of core skills. It can easily make students lose confidence in what they already know. If a student has acquired some powerful knowledge, learning may involve giving up that knowledge. And that actually should be difficult, not easy. So we shouldn't, in a sense, encourage them to give it up. The shift to learning has another knowledge-questioning consequence. Makes teachers feel that they should not be an authority over their pupils just because they know more. It is as if authority is something uncomfortable and undemocratic, and associated, and knowledge is associated, disassociated from learning, and easily associated with facts. And then you get things like E.D. Hirsch's lists of what every child should know. Another example of the fear of knowledge is found in the forms of culturalism that teachers often face that confuse the necessary respect for cultural values of a community with the truth of their explanations. Some of you know that in New Zealand, Maori people have separate schools, separate teacher education departments in the university, and distinct Maori curricula for maths and science. For example, 2 plus 2 equals 3 in Maori maths, because the maths is located in a particular context. In this case, a fishing community where the young are taught to hunt up to 4 fish and throw one back. Not as we do, draining the stock of cod, but in fact, supporting, continuing the resourcing the stock. Now that's all very fine in that context, but it causes very problems when we look at what happens to Maori kids in terms of their achievement in schools. And that's not to say that Maori separatism isn't relatively benign, nor that it's not chosen explicitly, unlike something like apartheid, it's not chosen explicitly by the Maori people themselves. Another thing worth mentioning about the attack on knowledge is often largely unnoticed outside the disciplines of social sciences and humanities, is a tradition of philosophy that has developed from people like Nietzsche, Heidegger, and Wittgenstein, following up to today's postmodernists such as Richard Rorty, Lyotard, and Derrida, that has actually made a critique of knowledge into an intellectual project. Now, this means, ironically, that the anti-knowledge educationists and social scientists can call on philosophy to make the case against knowledge as a support for their anti-knowledge arguments. These philosophers don't often write about education, but when they do, as in the case of a fashionable new French theorist, Rancière, you get a convoluted essay on the title The Ignorant Schoolmaster. There's a second irony which I want to mention, and that's it's almost a hypocrisy, I think. And I'm not sure even quite how to deal with it, but it certainly creates confusion. It was brought home to me some years ago when I gave a lecture at the Royal Society of Arts on what a school's for. There were 200 people in the lecture, and I got a lot of flack, a lot of attack, many of them from people who worked in community education. Because I was arguing, the argument I want to make now, about the main purpose of school is access to powerful knowledge. Even if it's not always realised in our schools for all pupils. I wasn't able to check the background of those attending, but they were all fellows of the Royal Society, and given how they are recruited, because they've tried to recruit me but not yet succeeded, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that virtually everyone in the room had a degree of some kind, and yet they were able to argue that knowledge that they had acquired should not be an entitlement for all children. It is, at the very least, it seems to me, it's a hypocrisy that gets in the way of a different approach to education in our culture. Another example, I was recently in Brazil, as I mentioned earlier, to a conference on the entitlement for children to core knowledge. Now, many teachers in state schools in Brazil, and almost every university faculty member I've ever met on my visits to Brazil, are against the idea of common core knowledge curriculum and for all children. They see it as a threat to the autonomy of teachers and denial of Brazil's cultural diversity. At the same time, most of them send their children to private schools, which ensure their children have access to core knowledge. I didn't invent this. I was told it by a member of the University of São Paulo who invited me and who is part of the group who are trying to actually bring about the idea of a core curriculum and actually some control over what teachers actually do. The context in Brazil is very different. It was not so long ago. It was a society based on slavery. However, the anti-knowledge educationists who oppose the need for a national core curriculum make, it seems to me, the same mistake as those who reject the current curriculum forms in this country. In Brazil, they associate any policy for a national Common Core curriculum with the anti-democratic military dictatorship of the 1980s, not with the potentially emancipatory power of knowledge. I think this is what, in fact, many anti-knowledge people do, associate the pro-knowledge curriculum with the policies, all the policies of Michael Gove and the Conservative Party, which they don't agree with. It seems to me this is an example of being unable to accept that there may be knowledge that is not tied to specific contexts. There are many things that need criticising about our current government, so education policy. But one is not, I think, the idea of a common curriculum for all up to 16. So this leads me to the most important and difficult part of what I want to say about knowledge. First, and it is this, how do we explain that it's educationists, mostly on the left, who support a more equal society in all spheres of life, who are so opposed to the idea of all pupils being entitled to knowledge? What has happened to the Enlightenment idea that knowledge is the only real resource of freedom? Freedom from being locked in one's experience, and freedom, as the sociologist Basil Bernstein said, to think the unthinkable and the not yet thought. Experience alone does not entitle, I think, anyone to freedom. Freedom has the right of all, but it has to be worked for and learned. However alien the potentially emancipatory knowledge may seem at first. And the teacher's particular responsibility, which we often don't recognise, is actually enabling that to be possible for young people who find it difficult. Because pedagogy is difficult is why in the most successful, educationally successful countries, teaching is one of the most highly respected professions, and education is the university faculty with the highest ratio of applicants to place, as in Finland. That would be unthinkable. Think of it, higher than medicine or law. So why are educationists not fighting for the enlightenment to knowledge for all, for the entitlement to knowledge for all, but actually opposed to it? We have to try and understand this. Now, I think we may be dealing with something much more than another academic argument. And it was expressed for me very well by the American philosopher, or English originally, I think, John Searle. So I want to read this little bit from John Searle. People who are convinced by social constructivism, he said, and by this he meant the view that all knowledge is tied to the circumstances and situations of its production, and therefore essentially relative. For them, is that there is no better knowledge. Now, John Searle argues that they have a deep metaphysical vision, and no kind of detailed refutations that you or I or anyone might make could address that vision. Their vision is one of creating the conditions for freedom, which they see as threatened by knowledge and its objectivity and its rationality and its association with science, the most rational form of human inquiry. The vision leads them to put their faith in experience and the knowledge people generate in the contexts in which they find themselves. It is as if reason has led them to oppose reason in favour of experience. It's difficult to know where, if anywhere, this leaves teachers or schools or education researchers who take that view. All they can do is to create critiques that provide no tools for enabling to envisage different possibilities. Here is an example of one such critic, a distinguished Australian sociologist who describes his idea of curriculum justice. It is, I quote, "a curriculum organized around the experience, culture, and needs of the least advantaged members of society, rather than the most advantaged as things stand now. A socially just curriculum will draw extensively on indigenous knowledge, working class experience, women's thinking about the curriculum, immigrant cultures, multiple languages, and so on. This, it seems to me, is where you get to in the curriculum if you focus on the knowers and their experience and not the knowledge in the thinking about, in thinking that they might want access to. It's in effect, such a process wants to roll back, I think, history to time where there were no schools. And life was, as Thomas Hobbes famously called it, nasty, brutish, and short. But then in that kind of society, there would be no place for such critics and no much place for Thomas Hobbes either. The alternative is not easy, but people will change their minds, and this must always involve some combination of thinking or theory and experience. In the final section, then, briefly, I want to describe a little bit about how I came to the idea of powerful knowledge and why I think it may be a useful idea of thinking about the curriculum. I was an enthusiastic social constructivist when my first book was published long ago in 1971. I endorsed the Pierre Bourdieu, the French sociologist, point that the curriculum is a cultural arbitrary, subjects a form of tyranny, pedagogy is species of symbolic violence. They all seemed evocative, radical ideas at the time. Later, I found myself describing this social constructivist approach as seeing the curriculum as knowledge of the powerful. Its strength was a reminder that power relations are always involved in the curriculum, as in any other aspect of educational society. How its focus, in its focus on power and who decides, it offered no constructive or no alternatives, except to hope that, in fact, the system would collapse. I was working in the 1990s with the democratic movement in South Africa, and that taught me, I think, more than anything, that I'd been wrong. The movement had overthrown apartheid, at least from the point of view of everyone having the right to vote. Many of these involved in the educational movement drew on Paulo Freire and identified with the slogan of people's education. This told them that knowledge and the view that curriculum was transmitted was the transmission of knowledge had been a tool of apartheid oppression to be overthrown, just like they had overthrown the laws which stopped blacks marrying whites and blacks not voting. So what they did in the early years after the first government was, with some help from a number of naive well-wishers from Europe, Australia, and New Zealand, like myself, they created a broad framework of values for a racially integrated, not in practice, but in theory, racially integrated education system. And they left teachers in the black schools free from what they felt had oppressed them under apartheid, any attempt to give detailed specification of what the curriculum might be. But of course, what happened was that teachers did not know what to do with the freedom. Most black teachers had barely been educated beyond their schooling and only had experience of following instructions from white managers. So in a sense, the schools became chaos. It was this context that gradually dawned on me that there is more to emancipation than critiques of the past, experience, and good values, important though all those are. What was lacking was any knowledge, any curriculum knowledge, any pedagogic knowledge, even if some of that knowledge was associated with, in their case, the hated apartheid system. When I got back to England, I had to face a number of academic critics of my earlier work. I started rereading Durkheim, Bernstein, and Vygotsky. And it was out of these two things, actually, rereading and, in fact, text that I had come across before and interpreted in different ways, and that South African experience, that I, in a sense, found myself needing to invert the terms power and knowledge. And the relationship between knowledge of the powerful became powerful knowledge, and this enabled one to ask, I felt, a whole new set of questions about the curriculum. It starts by making two assumptions, and they're difficult ones, but I think they're important. The first and the most basic is that, in fact, there is always better knowledge. There's always better knowledge in every field. Second, that at the root, all knowledge is differentiated. There's no kind of homogeneous notion, this is knowledge, that is not. And for education, the most basic distinction is between school or curriculum knowledge and everyday knowledge or experience of pupils bring to school. The third is that curriculum knowledge is context independent, knowledge, unlike the experience that pupils come to school, in which knowledge is tied to particular contexts, as that philosopher said was true about all knowledge that I quoted you earlier in the talk. It follows that the task of the teacher in drawing on the national curriculum is to enable pupils to engage with that curriculum and move beyond his or her experience. That is why it's so important for teachers to understand the difference between curriculum and pedagogy. The curriculum is a resource for charting the teacher's and the school's goals, whereas pedagogy refers to how the teacher engages with the pupil's prior experience to enable him or her to get access to the curriculum and to see his own or her own experience in a new way. That doesn't mean that, in fact, they are descriptively different, because actually in the everyday work of teaching in a school, curriculum and pedagogy come together. But when we're actually analysing and thinking about them, then I think it's very important to see those as different. And the pedagogy may involve things as diverse as reading a poem or doing a chemistry experiment. The teacher's goals will always be that the student has grasped the ideas and concepts and can then use that in new and different contexts. Five. Powerful knowledge, then, is specialised knowledge with its roots in the work of communities of specialists, which we talk about as disciplines. They are primarily organisations for producing new knowledge. But over time, disciplinary specialists, certainly since the early part of the middle of the 19th century, have worked with school teachers who have themselves studied their discipline. And drawing on that knowledge of how children learn, the levels that pupils have reached, and the context that they come from, have created subjects. This process is what sometimes described as recontextualization, taking knowledge out of a disciplinary context and putting it into a new context, the school subject. But it's a tough, difficult, unresearched area. Much of it is taken for granted. It's also important to emphasize that specialist forms of knowledge differ in their structure and the way in which they relate to the world. Obvious distinctions are between the sciences and social sciences and humanities. Each are the basis for core subjects in the school curriculum. The two most debated aspects of the concept of powerful knowledge, I think, are power and concepts. Power is so easily interpreted in terms of power over, and immediately one becomes resistant to it and critical and associated with elitism and so forth. You actually have to grasp the fact that power is not only power over, but in a sense, the power that knowledge gives you, that gives you power to do, to think, not necessarily power over somebody else. That's a whole different kind of relationship. Different subjects offer students different kinds of power and different types of knowledge with different purposes. For instance, some parts are the abstraction generalizations of sciences, some are the partial generalizations of social sciences, some are how novels, plays, and works of arts in the humanities are not a basis for generalization, but show how the particular is how the general is articulated in the general. For example, a great play or a story or whatever. Now, just to conclude and to make the idea of powerful knowledge a little more concrete, I want to read you something written by a head teacher of a comprehensive school who I met at a conference. I was very surprised. She came up to me after my talk and said, "I've read your book." And I never thought that head teachers read books in sociology of education, but obviously she was rather a unique head teacher. And what this has led to, among other things, is two things. One is that, in fact, a group of us are producing a book which makes a very conscious attempt to write about some of these ideas outside of the specialist fields of tertiary education that I work in. The other is that, in fact, she took the ideas away and she produced a kind of manifesto for her school. And if I can show you, which looks like this. I just want to... I can read it down here. So this is a knowledge-driven school, a manifesto. She distributed it to her staff, her heads of departments, her teachers, and she said to them, think about what you do in relation to this. And this is the introduction. We're the people who offer powerful and shared knowledge to the nation's children. We, the teachers. That knowledge comes from centuries of learning and from the research of universities and subject associations. It's powerful because it enables children to interpret and control the world. Shared because all our children should be exposed to it. It is fair and just that this should be so. It is unfair and unjust when children are offered poor quality knowledge which fails to lift them out of their experience. That is what, on the whole, those programs that I spoke to you about... Wait a minute, if I can get it. I'm not quite sure.
Oh.
Ah, right. Now, then she constructed in terms of 10 points of a manifesto. And when I went through these, I thought to myself... Despite having studied and thought and written about these things for a long time, I was pushed to be able to express it as well as she did. Here are 10 things to remember, she said. Knowledge is worthwhile itself. Tell the children this. Never apologize that they need to learn things. 2. Schools transmit shared and powerful knowledge on behalf of society. We teach what they need to make sense of and to improve the world. 3. Shared and powerful knowledge is verified through learning communities. We need to keep in touch with universities, research, and subject associations. 4. Children need powerful knowledge to understand and interpret the world. Without it, they remain dependent upon those who have it. 5. Powerful knowledge is cognitive superior to that needed for daily life. It transcends and liberates children from their daily experience. 6. Shared and powerful knowledge enables children to grow into useful citizens. As adults, they understand, cooperate, and shape the world together. 7. Shared knowledge is a foundation for a just and stable democracy. Citizens educated together share an understanding of the common good. 8. It is fair and just that all children should have access to this knowledge. Powerful knowledge opens doors. It must be available to all children. 9. Accepted adult authority is required for shared knowledge transmission. The teacher's authority to transmit knowledge is given and valued by society. I might say should be. Lastly, pedagogy links adult authority, powerful knowledge, and its transmission. We need quality professionals to achieve all this for all our children. I was very impressed that this was the way in which a head teacher of a large comprehensive school with 1,600 pupils interpreted some of the things that I had written. She's now gone on to become head of an even bigger school in South London. Some of you may know it, Thomas Tallis, and I think is making a great success of it. I've used this particular document at the end in a whole number of different countries that I had the opportunity to visit. And what strikes me all the time is that, in fact, that it has a kind of universalism about it. The people engage with it in such unlikely countries as Vietnam, and then more likely ones, Australia, New Zealand, and middle likely ones, Brazil. But those are some of the ones that I've tried, and in a sense, it just illustrates. But I think it gives me confidence that, in fact, we are kind of on the right lines, and that the more we talk to teachers, we may be able to achieve it. And in a sense, they will communicate it in the end to politicians. And in the end, politicians will have to find the resources to make that possible, because that's not going to be possible easily in all schools. Thank you.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.